The Trump administration has found something very important, which is that Fauci and the other criminals of COVID, as well as the Epstein files, are buried beneath Iran.
Why'd they put it there?
Yeah, right?
Welcome to Human Reaction, where we are here to dissect all the nonsense going on in the foreign policy world right now, as apparently we're at war with Iran or something, maybe? I don't know.
Well, at least Israel is, and that indicates that we are, because certain features of our government. And that's one reason why you need to comment on this podcast. Now, sometimes we talk about a certain country that the algorithm does not like to have negative coverage of, is my suspicion. Sometimes we get 200 views, sometimes we get 60 views. And it just so happens that when we get 60 views, it's almost always when we talk in a negative light about a particular country in the Middle East that is our greatest ally, I think. I don't know. Maybe not. Who knows? Anyways, that country.
With friends like these.
If you want to get outside the mononarrative, if you want friends and other people in our society to get outside the mononarrative on these countries and understanding, should we just, am I supposed to hate some other particular country called Iran that was bombed this week? You got to comment on this podcast. Help us get to more people. Like, subscribe, rank us, rate us on Spotify. That'll help get the message out to more people. Thank you so much for watching. Let's dive into it.
We got to make sure our Qatari funders are happy.
Yeah.
That's how it goes. Speaking of Qatari funders, no, wait, that doesn't make sense with the meme here. But I found this on Twitter, and I thought this was kind of funny. And it apparently pizza places around the Pentagon were doing exceptionally well last night.
Now, this is this is a theory I've heard before, yeah, which is right before a major attack, there's always a spike in pizza sales.
Mm-hmm. Which is like everybody knows what's going on, so it's like gonna be a late night at the office. So everybody's ordering in pizza for the Pentagon. Is that what's happening?
Apparently.
As of 9:59 p.m. Eastern time, nearly all pizza establishments nearby the Pentagon have experienced a huge surge in activity. This is like an hour before the strike happened.
This is a Google thing of people going there, right? So this is like the bombs are in the air. Let's go celebrate by going to a pizza place, right? Is this a pizza party or is this them ordering pizza in?
Oh, really? Because my thought here was that it was ordering pizza in. Like maybe they were sending in the lackeys to go pick up a bunch of pizza. A lot of pizzas were being made.
Yeah, because you can't have a delivery driver just drive up to the Pentagon to deliver pizza, I don't think. They have to send the intern. This is all interns going to get a pizza palace.
Yeah. This episode is brought to you by Revved Up Promo, the official apparel partner of Human Reaction. Revved Up is a premier full-service shop specializing in laser engraving, screen printing, and embroidery. Not only are they now making all of our apparel right down the road from us, they can do the same for your brand and ship it to you anywhere in the world. Revved Up helps you navigate the extensive universe of merch options and uses state-of-the-art techniques to showcase your brand in its very best light. So if you want to support our show and our generous sponsor, you can now do so by buying our merch and by turning to Revved Up Promo for your own custom apparel needs. Reach them at revveduppromo.com. That's with two V's and two P's, or just check the show notes for a link.
But I guess getting into it, because there was a lot of lead up that comes to this, and it has a lot of people with a lot of different theories, and there's just a lot of fog of war right now. A lot of anonymous sources saying different things. It's hard to know who's telling what's true, what's lie, yada, yada.
Yes.
So I guess let's just kind of take it through the ordering here, I guess, of the events. One thing that I did want to point out here was it is important to note that, and a lot of people kind of forgot about this, Trump around 60 days ago said that he is giving Iran 60 days to agree to a nuclear deal or face military action. And it is about 60 days now. So
it could be that. That does indicate some coordination with the United States, although that's a controversial or contested idea.
Yeah.
That we'll be diving through as we go. So yeah, we'll see.
Because that's the big question is like how much was the U.S. involved versus not involved? How much was Israel actually acting unilaterally? But in this case, like Trump did always have threats of violence on the table when it came to these deal making. So and then there's a question of like, was it always kind of planned to have the threats of violence versus is this just the ultimatum that it came down to? Like all of those are up in the air. But on the lead up here, one of the things that I found interesting was this was on Wednesday. Today's Friday. The attack happened Thursday night.
Yep.
So like in the Tuesday-Wednesday period, I noticed that there was a lot of vibe changes that were happening. Like a week ago, it was kind of like the Iran deal's coming along, pieces are coming together, negotiations are still happening, they're being kind of sticklers, but like those were kind of the vibes. Mm-hmm. And then Trump was on a show or a podcast and said this.
Do you think you're going to be able to stop Iran from enriching its...
I don't know. I did think so. Mm. And I'm getting more and more less confident about it. They seem to be delaying, and I think that's a shame, but I'm less confident now than I would have been a couple of months ago. Mm. Something happened to them, but I am much less confident of a deal being made.
Do you think you're going to...
That's not good.
Yeah.
So it's important to note that this Sunday, there was a planned meeting with between Witkoff and Iran's foreign minister in Oman. This would be the sixth round of nuclear talks since the Trump administration came in. And on Monday, you know, soon before that interview, he was indicating that this story from Wall Street Journal, Trump told Netanyahu on Monday not to attack Iran. Now, this has been a back and forth that we've covered before up to like weeks ago, where there were positive signals that we were suggesting, we are seeing, such as a plan that was started in the Biden administration for a regime change war in Iran. You know, is what it looked like, including sending in commandos and ground troops into Iran that the Trump administration rejected. Now, that's the question, is was it fully rejected or was it, well, I mean, you could take out their air defenses, but we're not going to do a whole regime change thing. We're going to use this as a pawn in our overall negotiations. Perhaps that's where it went.
Yeah. It's kind of, yeah, kind of where I'm coming down is like there's some sort of like in the middle of all of this that exists where like there's all these different actors. And so like the administration is kind of dealing with the cards that they have on the table. And so they're kind of like leaving all of their options open because we are so deeply tied with Israel. There's kind of this like, so like Israel's going to do certain things. So I was like, oh, fuck, we got to do, or it could just be like, we're completely coordinating with them 100% entirely.
Yeah. Well, and it's kind of, but it's kind of like wishing for rain and then not wanting to get wet.
Yeah.
Right. And that's the problem is that they seem to want to have their cake and eat it too.
There is that.
And then one of the other indicators here that was kind of leading in. So we had these signals, counter signals. We were on our signal group talking about this evacuation order earlier in the week, where military families in the region were announced to be removed. Mm-hmm. That was even picked up by CNN. And then when asked why, Trump had to say, you know, we'll see.
Yeah, it was like the Baghdad embassy got evacuated. A bunch of all the family and the Qatari airbase got evacuated. Mm-hmm. It was like a partial evacuation order.
Yes.
And this was just kind of right around the same time of that interview. I think it was like literally later that day is really? When it came in.
Yeah.
When that started happening.
So they continue to try to maintain this position of we are on the side of peace talks. We don't want Israel. Israel, don't attack. Hey, stop it. You know, so he puts out this message on the yesterday.
This was like 3 hours before the attack is when this came out. We remain committed to a diplomatic resolution to the Iran nuclear issue. My entire administration has been directed to negotiate with Iran. They could be a great country, but they first must completely give up hopes of obtaining a nuclear weapon. Thank you for your attention to this matter. I like that tag he keeps putting.
Thank you for your attention to this matter.
He keeps putting that at the end of all of his tweets for lately. It's funny. Thank you for your attention on this matter. Like, my gut is that Trump just finds it funny.
Yeah, right? You're like, you're the president of the United States.
Thank you for your attention. it will be funny because like sometimes when he's just like roasting somebody, it'll just be the end tagline. Thank you for your attention on this matter.
So Rubio continued to claim that this was Israel acting unilaterally.
Yeah, right right after the attack happened, it said, tonight Israel took unilateral action against Iran. We are not involved in strikes against Iran, and our top priority is protecting American forces in the region. Israel advised us that they believe this action was necessary for its self-defense. President Trump and the administration have taken all necessary steps to protect our forces and remain in close contact with our regional partners. Let me be clear, Iran should not target U.S. interests or personnel. And this is kind of the have your cake and eat it too aspect here. Is one of those things is it's like Israel. So like the narrative that they're setting up here is Israel is going to do this regardless. Mm-hmm. But we are still open to the deal. We're still open to it. So like as long as you don't attack any of our stuff, Witkoff can continue meeting with you on Sunday. Like that's kind of the narrative that they're setting up right here, right?
I just can't hear anything you're saying because I got Lindsey Graham on the right hand side with a cocktail and a bunch of naked dudes behind him.
Yeah, that is the top comment on there. Is AI Lindsey Graham having a whale of a tail?
So the thing is they put that out. They say, "Oh, Israel, stop! Please, don't attack them," and then this truth comes out the next day after the whole thing happens. This happens this morning, and I don't want to read the whole thing, but in short, it says, well, you know, I told you this might happen.
I think it's important to get the full context of what he's saying here. I think we should read it.
Read it, but do it in a Trump impersonation.
I gave Iran a chance after chance to make a deal. I told them in the strongest of words to just do it, but no matter how hard they tried, I'm not going to keep doing this, no matter how close they got, they just couldn't get it done. I told them it would be much worse than anything you know, anticipated, or were told that the United States makes the best and most lethal military equipment anywhere in the world, by far, and that Israel has a lot of it, which with much more to come, and they know how to use it. Certain Iranian hardliners spoke bravely, but they didn't know what was about to happen. They are all dead now, and it will only get worse. There has already been great death and destruction, but there is still time to make this slaughter, with the next already planned attacks being even more brutal, come to an end. Iran must make a deal before there is nothing left, and save what was once known as the Iranian Empire. No more death, no more destruction. Just do it before it is too late. God bless you all.
Thank you for your attention to this matter.
Thank you for your attention on this matter.
Okay. So what does that indicate? That very clearly indicates to me, especially in the section where he's saying they didn't see it coming, this idea that it was really, was the plan.
To be clear, they never said that they didn't see this coming.
I'm not saying that, but they're saying we have nothing to do with it. And we know materially that in the Five Eyes intelligence agencies, that Israel works very close with the CIA, especially when targeting them. They have to work with
Israel's not part of Five Eyes, though.
Right. Amongst the Five Eyes, right? Israel is one of the agencies that CIA works very close with when it comes to it. We've seen coverage from mainstream media outlets about the CIA, NSA, other organizations within the intelligence apparatus working with Israel on targeting in Gaza, much less targeting in Iran. We have far more satellites, far more capability to, you know, project outside. And then obviously, you know, that's not to say there's nothing to Mossad and their ability to pull off an operation and know things in other countries.
They're the best.
They're probably one of the best.
Probably the best. I mean,
especially when it comes to human intel.
When it comes to human, like any guy that I've talked to that's like CIA or just like listened to on podcasts or something, like they all always say like Mossad is the best.
Yeah. I think it's reasonable for people to read this and say this was the plan. Like you did this to create cover for Israel to do this as much of anything else.
Well, yeah, there is kind of like a good cop, bad cop aspect of this where like what it feels to me is Trump's not moving towards full-blown war and regime change, but it's like, here's the attack dog, Israel, go get them, because they're stalling this deal out way too long. And it's just kind of like, here's the threat, And this can continue if you don't come to the negotiating table. Like, that seems to be what's happening.
Well, I know. Okay, so that would be true if the ask was you cannot develop a nuclear weapon. But the ask has evolved.
You cannot enrich
anything. You have to give up your civilian nuclear program, your latent nuclear capability. So you can't be Germany. You can't be Japan. You can't be Brazil. You can't be any of the other countries in the world that have nuclear technology that we gave you in the Atoms for Peace program.
I don't think the evolution of that changes what I said, though.
Let me finish. Yeah. So to the... Man, you interrupted me. Now I can't remember what I was saying. The latent capability, you're not allowed that. You can't have a latent capability. So the ask is already an ask that they can't fulfill. So then they say, well, we can't do that. And it says, well, you're delaying talks. Right. So therefore, this is at best a ruse, if not a outright lie to the American people that he's indeed pursuing the path of peace, especially when we have reporting from Axios to suggest that for 8 months, this has been the build up to it. According to anonymous Israeli officials, this has been a coordinated plan with the Trump administration to lull them into a false sense of security so that they can do this surprise attack. Saying we're going to bring to the negotiating table, we want to negotiate, even claiming after the attacks that this is indeed what they're doing. I mean, it's too much to believe, especially, and then the Times of Israel also reported on this, we're probably the first, Al Jazeera's reported on this, that internal Israeli stuff is either giving the administration a bone saying, you can take credit for this, or this is indeed a subversive attempt to... use drones to create a regime change or use drones to substantially change the makeup of their government. But you have to believe that you can just kill officials and that will change the philosophy of the people of Iran when it comes to this issue. And that doesn't happen when you bomb a country. The rally on the flag phenomena happens. Like, people gather together and say, we're being attacked by an outside enemy, right? You're not going to get them to denuclearize now. That's going to be much harder, right?
Potentially. Like, one of the interesting pieces of this is that it's like all the major counterparties of all the different varying factions within Iran that have a seat at the table for these negotiations, like all of them except for Khomeini were kind of hit on this. Like, yeah. The head of the
supposed hardliners that he mentioned.
Yeah, yeah. The head of the Revolutionary Corps, who is essentially like... My understanding is they're like their own sovereign entity within Iran. Like, they have like as much power as Khomeini does there. So like when he gets hit, like that in itself is kind of interesting.
But he's going to be replaced with another guy who's not going to be like, well, I mean, now I want to go to the negotiating table. You killed my boss. Mm-hmm. Right. Like, so what is the theory of change here? That is either you have to believe that Trump administration and the Pentagon are dumb or bloodthirsty or... Are just giving Israel what it wants, which is to feel safer. Bibi Netanyahu himself said, and this was in the mid-2000s, that if in the disastrous scenario where Iran builds a nuclear weapon with continental ballistic missiles, not intercontinental, they don't have that technology, but continental ballistic missiles, what would happen? Well, the biggest fear is an Israeli brain drain. Would be Israelis living in Israel moving to the United States to live and work here and taking their tax dollars with them. It isn't that they would attack them, because of course if they did that, Israel already has nuclear weapons. They would destroy Iran, much less trigger a global nuclear war. Saudi Arabia would want to get weapons. Nuclear proliferation would be a real problem for Iran in many different elements rather than just this. You have to believe, which I don't think Trump believes, and I don't think the Pentagon actually believes. I think this is just a talking point Mark Levin says, that Israel is an insane regime full of crazy people who just want to die in the name of Allah and don't give a... And just,
Iran.
Yeah. Iran is that regime.
Israel too.
Yeah, a little different though. And in this whole negotiation, there's only one country here who's not part of the nuclear non-proliferation treaty. There's only one country here who's currently committing an ethnic genocide. Or an ethnic cleansing. Sorry. I don't want to use the G word. That's Israel. Mm-hmm. They're the ones with nukes in this situation. So, like, the hypocrisy and the theory of change is so, like torturous, it's hard for me to believe it. At least that's how I'm thinking about it.
Yeah. I mean, none of this, or, like, the evolution of argument of from nukes to nuclear enrichment or whatever, like, none of this changes the potential theory of Trump still wanting there to be a deal that's made, but then him using Israel as an attack dog. Like, I still completely see that as something that's relevant.
I would believe that if it was a reasonable ask that they could fulfill, right? But obviously the game is make an unreasonable ask they can't do. It's like the mobster showing up and saying, "I want one, exactly. I want 200%."
It is mobby.
Yeah. But let me, but it's the mobster that has decided that they can't do the thing for the overt reason, so they come up with a justification, right? The overt reason is I want to punish this guy because he hit on my daughter, but my actual reason is like, well, actually, you're behind on your payments, so I'm going to come in and I'm going to make up a new reason why I have to break your legs. Does that make sense? That's closer to that than it is to I actually really want peace, because otherwise you'd be fighting over a nuclear weapon. You would be doing the JCPOA thing rather than this new thing, which is we're going to eliminate enrichment completely and have America run your nuclear power plants or something like that.
Yeah, it is possible too that the enrichment side is kind of the over-ask for the eventual
nuclear
stuff too. Like that could be the reason for that changing, but it also could just be that this is Israel's non-starter, is that they have to completely get rid of the enrichment side, because like that's the complicated issue, is that there's so many different parties involved in all of this and they're all trying to get different asks. So, and then you have kind of the United States being the mediator in between, trying to be like, let's come to an agreement. But like the United States is obviously more on one side than the other side too. Yeah. So like they're not exactly the greatest mediator in this.
Well, on top of that. Yeah, exactly. But on top of that, like if you make an impossible ask and then they say no, then you have, and then you generate, which we'll get into a second, this IAEA report that says that they're out of compliance with the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty and they're going to get censored. Then you have this cause belli. You have this reason why it's legitimate now that your hawks can then repeat and then try to indoctrinate the American people with. That's why, I mean, if the ask was reasonable, I would be like, yeah, you're there. If it's an over ask, then that's what I was hoping it would be for all this time, right? When I heard him say this, I was like, okay, hopefully this is Trump just being Trump, asking for more than he actually wants. But, you know, I'm not sure that wouldn't have been the place we got to unless it was just cover for Israel to actually try to take out their leadership. Mm-hmm. So, and this is how it's been happening. Like the dynamic was, and I pretty clearly remember this from January to March, it was, and I remember Witkoff and Trump being criticized from the Iran hawks that their comments were Iran cannot have a nuclear weapon. As of May till today, that has changed. And I had hoped that the change was a negotiation tactic, but I'm beginning to believe that it is now their actual position that is this.
But on the other hand, we have one very, very clear red line, and that is enrichment. We cannot allow even 1% of an enrichment capability. We've delivered a proposal to the Iranians that we think addresses some of this without disrespecting them. And so that's important. We want to get to a solution here, and we think that we will be able to. But everything begins from our standpoint, John, with a deal that does not include enrichment. We cannot have that, because enrichment enables weaponization, and we will not allow a bomb to get here. But
and that's the problem, is that they're not drawing a distinction between this is Steve Witkoff, by the way. There is a distinction between a latent nuclear capability, such as what Brazil, Japan, Germany, so many other places have, and having nuclear weapons. And we don't draw that distinction. You are now in the area of saying, you got to be Libya, Iran, sorry. And they're saying, no, I want to avoid the curvy sword situation, right? And if that's where you're at, then that's where you're like, there's no go there. So if you're bringing an unreasonable ask and then you don't back off of it when they say no after five rounds of talks, then especially if the first round of talks you're saying no nukes and then you introduce no enrichment and you move your position, that's terrible negotiating, right? It's like going to the farmer's market and be like,
it depends on the it depends on all the pieces at the table.
But think about it, like you're at a farmer's market and you're selling bananas, you know, you're selling bananas and you say, make an offer. And I say, you know, $30 $10 for the bananas. And then you say, well, I'll take it for 12. And I'm actually, well, 8 actually. $8. You know, like, it's like, that's not how negotiation works. You're supposed to meet in the middle. Like, you.
Well, no. Well, I mean, if you identify that the, like, in poker terminology, if you identify that the other side doesn't actually have the cards, or they're not within range of where that compromise would actually be, you are in the right to continue to push further, though, too. And that could be what's happening here, too.
But
is that there is, like, we can push this thing further.
To translate into terms, that means regime change. Mm-hmm. Right.
I'm saying nuclear enrichment. Like, they might have came to this conclusion that they could draw, that they could push further on the nuclear enrichment side because of data that is at the table for them for that. And it's like, I don't know what that data would be, but like, that could be the reason. Like, that doesn't mean it's terrible negotiation because they're pushing further than what they originally had. Like, if you have the opportunity to push further, everybody's always going to push further.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. If what you're not trying to do is peace. Right, though, if what you're willing to do is regime change, yeah. But the next step of that, if you bomb them, now you have the rallying around the flag phenomena, right? Which happens every single time. You don't bomb a country and they go, oh, well, I guess you have some good points.
You're automatically jumping to the regime change. And I don't think that that's necessarily the big leap that has to be made here. Like, I think you're
to get them to actually give up enrichment. Yeah, I think that's what you have to do. I think it's that big of a deal.
I think no, but like, for the sake of on the negotiating side right now, like, there is a lot. There's still a lot of variables at the table. Like, we're not there yet. We could get there. I'm saying we could get there.
Let me be clear. What I'm saying is not that the Trump administration has a plan for regime change. I think neocons around the administration do.
Yeah,
and we've been talking about that for several months. But I do think is that they have ambitions and goals that will only can be accomplished by regime change because of the Libya phenomena. Because of the, think about it, like, the U.S. military was embarrassed in Afghanistan. NATO, you know, destroyed any credibility that we have on nuclear nonproliferation when we basically overthrew Libya, and then after they peacefully gave up their nuclear weapons, an enrichment in a very similar deal. And then, so, of course, we can't be believed then. And then we now have said repeatedly, we want peace. And, you know, Israel, don't attack them, don't attack them. When, in fact, it was actually us working with them all along, probably.
Well, and also, just, it's not just Israel. Like, a lot of the nations surrounding to the west of Iran in general are against Iran as well. Like,
sure.
On this, too. So, there is kind of a pressure that comes from all of the above, not just Israel in this, too.
But they're the ones seen as our client state, right? I mean, naturally, because we give them billions of dollars in our weapons, right? So, of course, the Iranians are not dummies. They're not, like, believing the rhetoric here that says, like, oh, please don't hurt them. You know, like, that's not, they're not, who's this for? This is for domestic politics. This is to keep America first together as they endorse a new Middle Eastern war, of which Americans will probably be drug into, because Iran's probably going to attack the United States and our troops in the Middle East, based on this. They're not going to attack the American homeland. They don't have that capability, at least according to current intelligence, as I understand it. They don't have intercontinental ballistic missiles, but they can attack, you know, troops stationed around the Middle East.
No, yeah, I'm trying to paint, too, though, like, the war is the worst case scenario, but, like, I don't think we're there yet. Like, I don't think we're, like, we haven't seen the counterattacks yet. We haven't seen attacks on military base, on U.S. military base or anything like that. Like, there might be intelligence that we as the public are unaware of right now on this at this point in time. So, like, I'm hesitant to get too leaped on board with, like, we're all of a sudden moving into, like, a drastic war and regime change right now. Like, I still see, like, the talks could be happening at the table. Like, I'm very curious for what Sunday holds, because the like, it's not like Steve Witkoff is going to Iran. They're going to a neutral meeting ground in Oman, I think is what it was, where he's meeting with the Iranian foreign minister.
Right.
So I will be very curious to see what happens there, because, like, it's hard to really make super judgments until that day happens.
So I'm not saying I know for certain that this will spiral out of control, but the history of exchanging of attacks do spiral out of control in many circumstances, but not always. This is a very different attack than what we've seen in the past between Israel and Iran. This is attacking one of their major, you know, leverage points for their future security. right? So yeah, like this isn't on the same level three of different attacking Soleimani.
Three different nuclear facilities, I believe.
Right, or an embassy attacked in Syria, or mm-hmm. any of those things. This is very different from that. This is a much bigger escalation in that story. So will Iran escalate to an equal and opposite degree? That's a good question. And then, let's dig into the operational.
I did see unconfirmed reports that they're preparing an official statement of war. It's one of those things that's unconfirmed, though. Mm-hmm. That'll be another thing that's curious is like, do they actually go to war with Israel? Because for so long, for decades, it's always been this like tick for tack thing that's going on. It's like, okay, you struck our stuff. Now we're going to strike your stuff. And we're just going to keep doing this back and forth every now and then. And then both sides save face. So if there is like an official declaration of war, that will be the thing where it's just like, okay, yeah, like
maybe it's really on now.
Maybe it's really on, but maybe let's get into like the casualties of like who got struck, the places that got struck,
right,
and stuff like that. Cause that's important details for context here.
As much as I'm a giant, libertarian peacenik type, I find fascinating how this operation, this is somewhat unconfirmed operational details. So it looks like there's somewhere between 3 to 5 waves with hundreds of targets all over Iran, some of them being nuclear facilities, some of them being like what this shows is a footage from a drone attacking a station, like an anti-air station, as it goes in here and blows this thing up.
Well, and this is actually one of those questions too, because like, there's almost this looking from a, from a distance, just seeing everything on Twitter unfold last night. You're like, this felt really easy. Like just overall, this felt like way easier than I would have thought it would have been, which does offer that like the credence to the idea and kind of what Trump was saying is like, this was a ruse to lull them into a false sense of security. All of their important people weren't in bunkers and mm-hmm. like all in all the protective areas that they needed to be in, there is kind of that dynamic.
I have a hard time imagining Iran does not have Twitter and didn't see the delegations being pulled out of the Middle East.
Yeah,
right. But that said, don't underestimate Mossad, right? So part of this is, this appears to be a strike according to unconfirmed operational details, that where they snuck in weapon systems into Iran itself, right? So if your radar and your operational systems is focused outwards for ballistic missiles being fired from Israel, you don't see that it's actually a block, down the street coming at you from behind, right? And this, like in boxing analogy, it's not the strongest hit that necessarily knocks the fighter out. It's the hit that they don't see coming, right? So in this case, that smaller, lighter hit that's actually not seen coming appears to have knocked out a lot of their operational capability and anti-air. So this has been predicted by others, and it makes sense to me that this is likely the first wave in what's going to happen over days, if not weeks, if regardless of whether or not Iran acts or to what scale they act, where they're planning on taking out more now that they have, operational dominance in the skies. I want to note that this whole sneaking a drone in to then do operations internally is also the operation that they did in Ukraine. This is called Operation Spiderweb. We didn't really get to cover it. We had other stuff we were covering at the time. But on June 1st, Ukraine did an operation using Chinese drones smuggled into Russia to attack Russia's nuclear bomber fleet. So as you were sleeping in your beds in early June, little did you know that we crept up to the brink of nuclear war when Ukraine bombed their basically their equivalent of B-52 bombers that they used to deliver nuclear payloads in a hot war.
Well, and it's also clear that Israel has a lot of embedded assets into Iran, because there's been all of these different assassinations that have happened over the last year or two, like the helicopter going down.
I don't think it was ever confirmed an assassination, but it was largely speculated. But I remember what you're talking about.
You look at it and you're like, that's
Kyle, right. It was foggy. Okay.
it was foggy. Sometimes roofs be sloped. it's like that type of thing, right?
Yeah.
There was, who was it? Like in a hotel room blew up several months ago. I think this was when Biden was still in office.
Yeah.
There was somebody important in the Iranian structure that got hit. I can't remember, but like it's one of those things where Israel clearly has a lot of embedded assets. So like the idea of bringing in a drones domestically inside, it's like, yeah, probably.
Right. And, probably. And it does show like some signals intelligence, operational dominance mm-hmm. that Israel probably has in Iran where they can operate these remotely without their signals being interrupted. There also suggests, you know, that at least temporarily they have air dominance, and then noting that a lot of what Iran does to protect themselves for a second wave capability to strike back is hide this stuff underground. You'll see a lot of videos from the Iranians showing these large underground bunkers where they're hiding, where they have their equipment that they will now roll out into the streets and then fire rockets at. That's the idea of what's likely to happen.
Well, and that's the question too, is like, most of Iran's nuclear infrastructure is underground. So how much of this actually hit the, like, yeah. what matters? Like, the nuclear bases themselves or the facilities themselves got caught on fire. There was like video that was seen of mm-hmm. the Natanz nuclear facility that got set on fire. But like all that stuff's underground. So it's like kind of, how set back were they? Now, a lot of the scientists got hit, like a lot of the lead scientists, which mm-hmm. is interesting. Like I have this guy right here. I'm not going to go through all of the important casualties because there's just a lot of people that people aren't going to like know who they are. But the former head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Fehreddin Abbasi Devani.
Take it.
Is confirmed to have been eliminated. There was a lot of these types of people that were like the nuclear tech guys that were part of the negotiation deals mm-hmm. That were struck in there. Then also one of the more important figures that got hit was the IRGC chief. He was killed in the strikes. And this is kind of who I was saying before, where it's like this entity, the Revolutionary Guard Corps, they are kind of like their own quasi-sovereign entity within Iran. Mm-hmm. So he got hit. So Iran was making a lot of these, Israel was making a lot of these really big claims of like, we've wiped out, we've assassinated their entire military leadership. Like they were mm-hmm. making kind of these claims. Now there was a lot of people in the military leadership that did get struck. And a lot of these are kind of the hardliners, as Trump had put it on the negotiation side. So that in itself is kind of interesting, but.
Right. So the question is can you actually take out enough people to not just set them back, right? So, of course, taking out leadership probably throws command structures into disarray. If you're in a war, in a Cold War with Israel, you would establish, of course, like who then becomes leader if the top person dies. So how much it's going to disrupt? Don't know. You know, but will it actually end their capability? Probably not. Not yet. I imagine if you're going to try to drop a bunker buster onto a nuclear facility that can get down low enough to cause the back pressure mm-hmm. to collapse the actual facility, you're going to need like bombers, not drones. You're going to need much larger payload, much heavier payload. So this first attack is likely establishing air dominance so that they can then go in at some point when there's no air defense and then drop these bombs. That's like, I mean, that makes most sense to me, although I'm not a military strategist. If this was Civilization though, that's what I would do.
If we're playing a grand strategy game, which we kind of are, that's what Lindsey Graham is doing. His tweet is like, game on.
Yeah. Oh, God, that's disgusting.
But so I guess a lot of this comes into question then is the reason for the attack is that apparently Iran was 5 minutes away from a nuclear weapon. I saw a congressman saying like literally like 5 minutes away.
I know they've been claiming that since 1981.
I've seen anywhere last night from all of Congress. I saw anywhere from 5 minutes to 5 hours to 5 months. So they're in some time between 5 minutes and 5 months of getting a nuclear weapon.
So according to our assessment, based upon Mark Levin's quoted source of the Austrian FBI.
We covered this in a Skiff episode a couple weeks ago.
It would take about a year to take from their current latent nuclear capability to a nuclear capability. That said, there's no intelligence, according to the Director of National Intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, that they have an active policy of pursuing a nuclear weapon. Instead, they have a latent nuclear capability, just like Brazil, Japan, you know, Germany, to develop. They've mastered the fuel cycle, so they can do that thing, but they have not decided to do it. So one of the pretexts, the cause belli for the actual strike, of course, that now that the hawks can now roll out, is that the IAEA put out a report that morning, based upon a that then provoked a IAEA. This is the International Atomic Energy Agency. Censoring Iran for being out of compliance with the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. So I have a New York Times article on there. You want to? It should open up for you.
No, it doesn't.
Man, I'm trying to figure out a way to oh, goddamn.
I don't know what's going on.
Oh, sorry, buddy. Sorry. Yeah, I wanted to.
If you gave me
the
URL, I can archive.is it.
No, don't worry about it. So basically, U.S. and Western allies voted yes on Russia, China, in Russia and China voted no, right? Iran claims it's all political. I think there's some good evidence of that, but took the opportunity to also note that it is now enriching even harder now with announcing a new facility and upgrades to its nuclear facilities. This is one of those like interesting damned if you do, damned if you don't things. So like the report uses information from the early 2000s when they were actively pursuing enrichment before they had actually mastered the fuel cycle to the degree that we understand that they do now, where they said, where there was nuclear fissile that went missing, right? Mm-hmm. So the report says the material evidence for them being out of compliance is based upon evidence of the early 2000s. And then they say they also didn't give us all the information we requested. And, you know, they are out of compliance with that. Now, this didn't do what it should have done, right? So if we were still in the JCPOA, this report and the vote on the report would have caused what was called a snapback provision of the JCPOA, meaning it would have automatically caused a sanction regimes from all these other countries in the world on Iran who are signatories to the JCPOA. But because Trump pulled out, Iran no longer has to abide by the JCPOA and the snapback provision doesn't apply. So other countries are still in the JCPOA, right? So this is a censor. A censor motion, not a snapback motion. That's why they didn't do a snapback motion, is because supposedly this is for to continue negotiations so that they still have the card to play of sanctions on top of the hot war that they're now in.
And the other countries that are still in the Iran nuclear deal, that's what the JCPOA is, just for...
Yeah.
Is that that's set to expire?
In October, yeah.
Who else is all part of the deal?
This is like... France, Germany, yeah. England, the UN, or not the UN, the EU broadly is another actor in it, and then Russia, China, India, places like that. And with those, you know, a lot of the ones that are in it are not in it in the sense of it's not an active thing because America is the one that makes it run, right? Exactly. So when America pulled out, it pretty much screwed the entire process. Iran said, hey, we're still in it. We still want to be in it, mm-hmm. but we're not going to abide by an agreement that you made with us and then pulled out of. Mm-hmm. That's why that diplomacy was so disastrous, because a lot of the reporting that they accuse of them not following through on in this has been assessed by other people outside the IAEA, which is a political body. It's not just nuclear and neutral people. As would have been available if we were in the JCPOA to this day. It's strange because I'm not a fan of Iran. I don't want it. But when our government is such a... I've never been. But when our government is such a bad actor in these areas, lying to Iran, lying to us, jumping out of its own agreements consistently... not as the individuals who are at play, but as an institution, so inconsistent, of course you're going to sit yourself in a situation where no one trusts each other anymore and everyone is operating on this subversion technique that how do you get to a reliable peace when everyone's lying all the time and then doing agreements and then pulling out agreements? Like, there's something to the institutionalist, like old school approach of saying, like, look, our agreements have to mean something, right? And if we just treat them like they're nothing, then it's going to have long-term consequences where all of a sudden you have a degrading game to the baseline. And the baseline is anarchy and the worst kind of anarchy, which is large cartel-like governments going to war with each other.
Well, and there is a thing there too where just because, you know, we're cycling through leaders every 4 to 8 years, new agreements are going to be with people with completely differing like foreign policy views on like who's the enemy, who's not the enemy, et cetera. You know, like I imagine Putin feels this way in Russia, right? Mm-hmm. Where it's like every 4 to 8 years, it's all of a sudden like, well, who am I dealing with now?
Yeah.
You know, like, is this a Russia hawk? Is it, do they have like a Russophobia or something, or are they willing to conduct some sort of peace agreement? You know, like,
yeah,
like it becomes that thing where how do you operate in a long-term view with any of these democratic nations, really?
Yeah.
That are cycling through leadership all the time.
Yeah. And that's the best case of the Mencius Molbug thesis of why monarchy's great. But on the other side of that, there was a tradition in American politics for 100 years of largely we understand there's a massive cost to violating our own agreements, mm-hmm, and pulling out of them. And then we just decided that wasn't important anymore. Don't get me wrong, there were good reasons why we decided that wasn't important anymore, because our leaders had degraded our public trust so much that the American people were like, fuck it, we'll do the reality TV star guy now. I mean, he's got to be better than the neoliberals. And I understand that. I'm totally sympathetic to that point of view. But the cost here could be this.
Although that being said, too, on the cycling through leadership point, I remember Putin had a statement at one point where he was asked, like, who would you prefer to work with on like whichever president or whatever? And he's like, it doesn't matter who president is. I work with the CIA.
Yeah.
like that's who I'm dealing with.
That's
which is, that in itself is kind of its own thing. Cause like there are times in this where the rhetoric side of everything between like, whether it's a Republican president or a Democrat president or whatever, like the rhetoric side is vastly different, mm-hmm, but the actual policy side when it comes to our geopolitics isn't that different typically. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We're getting there feels to be a bit more of a transformation in that on the Trump side with the current state of the State Department on the diplomacy side and stuff. But like, it's still not like a drastic change. Like there's like a change, but it's not like an overwhelming drastic change.
Yeah. I mean, like the question is like, to what degree are we being realists in this, or are we just being nationalists, right? A nationalist realist camp that is like America first, as articulated by a lot of people around Trump, is something that's very compelling to me as a change. But if the change is just, we're going to do the same thing, but we're going to put a American flag on top of it.
Better than a pride flag?
Is it? I just can't care. I can't care if we're not gay with our bombings anymore. I want to be not bombing. And when, you know, especially the black pill for me in this is like, if it is an 8th month operation that was actually done behind the scenes in order to lull Iran into a position of defense, of lower defenses, then are we doing anything different? You know, this feels exactly just we're doing the bidding of Israel in this regardless, right? We don't need to do any of this. We didn't need to offer them the intelligence to do all this targeting. We didn't need to do all of this stuff. We are now promising to defend Israel in this. Mm-hmm. Like Trump put out a Truth Social that said now, and if they strike back, if you defend yourselves from this aggressive action from Israel, you are now, we're going to have more problems.
It is
like, that's an insane position, right? I mean, like you can't both have it that we're not part of this, and if you attack Israel, we're now part of this. That's not how that works.
It is interesting on like the public perception side right now of, like I saw these images that I was just compiling like all the congressmen and senators and like all of their statements within like the first 30 minutes of this, and everything's just like pray for Israel, blah blah blah, like all this stuff, Iran is terrible. There is kind of an interesting dynamic where like Israel's the one that attacked and that everybody's like pray for Israel in this moment.
Yeah.
Like there is kind of an interesting dynamic that exists there.
Marjorie Taylor Greene put out one that said pray for peace.
Yeah.
And I was like, "Oh my god, yeah, someone has some like
Yeah, Marjorie Taylor Greene was like one of the few congressmen she's somebody that's like surprised me on how anti-war she's become.
Yeah.
But then I'm seeing the public perception, and like, you know, most of my perception is going to be coming from Twitter, like politically active Twitter, but in mass, it's largely everybody, like even a lot of people that have traditionally been kind of more war prone in a lot of ways are very much like, why are we doing this? Don't do like Israel's pulling us into another thing, or like everybody has a different narrative, but like this general sentiment is, let's not do this. Like, let's not be so actively involved in Iran. Like, that seems to be the public sentiment at large. Not across the board. Like, there's the hardcore Zionist side, but it seems like it's weighted more towards like, let's get out of all this Iran business.
Well, I think the public sentiments from people in this moment are really important because it gives you an insight to how they actually understand this issue, especially when they're not themselves like necessarily big players in the geopolitical game. And there's a lot of debate that's understandable out of that. I do wonder, you know, to what degree a lot of the we are neutral stuff is just to play to domestic politics. It has nothing to do with the actual international goals. I mean, don't get me wrong. I think the Trump administration overall has the desire and has articulated a desire that is sympathetic to me. But I don't know if they're lying to me now. They're lying to everybody. So why wouldn't they lie to me, right? If they're lying to me about, oh, we actually really want a foreign policy that's realist and based upon American interest. And then they spend all this time making sure Israel feels nice and safe. I don't think you are. Like at some point I'm gonna lose patience with this whole thing and say I don't have the capability of just assuming they're the 51st state because they're not.
The signal to me still seems like full blown war is not like war is always on the table. Like, and some people just put it as a last resort and some people put it as like a second resort. The prioritization towards war still seems very low within the administration right now. Even with all this happening, like with the ruse that's being played, that still doesn't seem like war is the thing that's being pushed heavily towards. I'm there's a part of me that's sitting here like I've listened and watched the Iran stuff for so long, and every single time there's a thing that happens, it's always like this is going to be the one that sets off the war, and then it never actually happens, and it's actually way more nuanced than that. Like Soleimani is one of those, right? Where it's just like it never actually happened. And like, you know, like they ended up doing a tick for tack, hit a military base that we evacuated. And it was like, you know, all things resulted in,
but that said,
not being,
that is an early part of an escalatory spiral that we could be going into. I'm open to that. This turns into a bit of a nothing burger unless they actually,
I don't think it's going to be a nothing burger.
You can't understate to what degree the escalation is upon us if we are bombing their nuclear facilities, because the nuclear facilities is their guarantee of it not being the curvy sword scenario.
Yeah, they don't want
to. I feel like I'm talking like Kanye right now, where I'm like, it's all symbolism, right?
With the curvy sword is a symbol for.
I put on the curvy sword hat. You know, it's like, I don't know.
Well, but like.
But you see what I mean? Like,
That's the thing. That's the thing that all. Like, I feel like when Trump was in the negotiations with North Korea during Trump 1.0, I feel like that was one of the things that Kim Jong-un specifically said is that he doesn't want a Gaddafi scenario, or like North Korean officials said that, like they very specifically referenced the Gaddafi situation.
Yes.
Which I think is a very important one. Like there is like an archetypal symbol that Gaddafi has become when it comes to all of these leaders.
Don't trust
like,
America.
Like Bashar al-Assad, I think, was very much in that, and it took 20 years to get rid of Bashar al-Assad, but eventually he got rid of during the Biden administration and is now chilling out, starting up a dentist practice in Russia or something.
Right. but that's exactly right. Don't trust America. They will prosecute a war on terror against al-Qaeda and then endorse a former al-Qaeda leader as the new head of Syria. Well, you know, don't trust America. They will get Gaddafi to give up his nuclear weapons and then curvy sword. Don't trust America. He will arm Iraq against Iran for 20 years and then turn around and overthrow him. You know, whatever you do, do not trust America. And that is the constant signal that they are giving to the world. And then we're surprised when the world doesn't trust us or like us very much.
Although that being said, is like the other actors in the Middle East now, the other major actors seem to be much more in the like, we're willing to trust America side, but it's Iran is kind of this like stick in the mud.
No, they've been at this bought point in time, by right? America. They're saying we will be true. Client states of America, and that's what the Abrahamic Accords functionally were, and they're capitulating. And I'm not saying they should or shouldn't. I'm not judging them for that decision. I'm just saying this isn't freewheeling. This isn't free peoples or free states who are making this decision in a state of equality of peoples. This is I'm going to submit. Commit to the global hegemon in order to not be bombed into death, right? But even then you can't, because the reason why, Assad was that guy in the 1990s. He was our guy, right? There's reports of the internet, and this is really great. So Tucker Carlson had what's his name, the diplomat finance guy,
Jeffrey Sachs.
Jeffrey Sachs on awesome interview, hitting lots of different international stuff. But he points to this interesting report of the International Monetary Fund talking about how stable Syria was in the early 2000s, how multicultural it was, how peaceful it had become. That totally matches what my understanding and everything that I experienced with people that I knew in the State Department, or not necessarily in Congress in 2013. In 2013, Syria was one of the model states for the Middle East as a multicultural, multi-ethnic, religiously tolerant society that had its problems, but it wasn't a basket case.
Then they got a pipe. Then they started working on a pipeline with Russia.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of it came down to the energy side.
Yeah, and on top of that, Obama and the IRA and the NED decided they wanted to take on Russia because the hegemony is the problem. The hegemony is the thing that drives all this. If you look at this IAEA report and you don't see the hegemony trying to give a justification for what they're about to do, what they already decided they were going to do, if you look at we're going to move the ball from nuclear weapons to nuclear enrichment, that's the hegemony talking. That's not Trump talking, right? In a very symbolic sense.
In a lot of ways,
that's that desire for domination everywhere.
In a lot of ways, it's ExxonMobil talking. Because a lot of things come down to the energy side.
Yes.
Like that's what a lot of things came down to with Ukraine. That's what a lot of things came down to with Syria. A lot of it is who is the energy distributor and who's running the energy trade.
Hegemony just isn't about who is dominant in a military capacity. It is also our corporatism as a combination of factors between the military as the arm, the enforcement arm of major corporations, major American corporations to exploit people all over the world. And then we're surprised when people all over the world don't like us for that. Mm-hmm. And for God's sakes, bro, the whole reason we have this relationship with Iran is because we overthrew their country and installed the Shah. And now we want to do it again. And we did that on behalf of British Petroleum. Not for us. It wasn't Exxon that was there. So like that is the thing, that is the force, that is the culture, that is the clique, that is the deep state that exists, that is pushing this stuff. If you're going to fight the deep state, you have to starve it of this stuff.
Because a lot of the geopolitical decision making, and somebody that I thank for highlighting this for a lot of people is Mike Benz, is the promotion of our national champions around the world. And the energy side is like one of those major sides where it's like, it'll be our businesses or British Petroleum or whatever. there's the European aspect on it, where we're pushing for, actually he uses this great example. And I forgot about this. I was just listening to a Mike Benz interview the other day, and he was talking about during the fall of the Soviet Union, how Gorbachev was in Pizza Hut commercials.
Yeah.
And that's kind of like a really useful analogy for understanding of like, okay, we're in this regime change of the Soviet Union, moving into the new Russia, which goes into a more free market space. And what it really helped happen, and Gorbachev played a role in this, in the de-Stalinization of the Soviet Union, was the promotion of Pizza Hut within Russia. So now Pizza Hut has this massive market, right? Mm-hmm. Like that's one of the things to always look at, is like we're trying to spread American markets into these places so that we can dominate them economically with our with our businesses, with our champions.
Yeah.
In these places. And Iran is a place that, you know, we've been doing this economic stalemate sanctions and everything for so long, and we're trying to starve them out so that we can slip our markets in there and kind of control who is on top in that so that they play ball with us. And that's what we saw with like Afghanistan and things like that. Like when like the new head of Afghanistan is like a World Bank guy.
So the other side of that is the reason why Iran wants to have a civilian nuclear program is so that they can use their domestic uranium in the ground, uranium resources, to create electricity for their people. It also acts as a latent nuclear deterrent. If you remove that, they now have to burn oil or rely on another country to produce power for them. When was the last time that Iran did not have control over its own domestic resources? When it was a colony of Britain. Mm-hmm. And then soon after, when it became a dictatorial regime under the Shah.
Well, and actually,
do they want to go back to that? Will they ever want to go back to that? How much will that impact their ability to decide their own destiny as a people? Not saying that I'm a fan of Iran. I'm just saying that is what peace means. Peace means that they're able to be peaceful and decide their own destiny with their own money and compete with us in the marketplace of oil production and energy production, all that kind of stuff.
Well,
but we can't allow that. That's the insanity of the hegemonic regime, is that we can't allow any of that to exist anywhere in the world. Otherwise, we have to threaten nuclear war.
Well, this is one of those things where this is kind of the inherent con of globalism and kind of global trade in a lot of ways, is it creates all these entangling alliances that now, when this happens, there's a chain of effects that requires all these other different countries to get involved and so on, because everybody has like this economic tie in with that thing. And, you know, we're way more economically tied to Israel than we are with Iran. So like anything that's happening to Israel, we now have to kind of jump in some way because we have these certain economic ties and political ties. Israel's maybe a bit different. Like there's some other stuff that's going on there, just like on the political influence intel game. Like it's actually probably less so about the economics and more so about like this other stuff. But like
APAC,
but like, yeah. But some of that like has the economic ties, but like in some ways where when George Washington warned of entangling alliances, like there is kind of this, you know, we're moving towards maybe a little bit more of a nationalistic economic model where we're doing a lot of stuff on our own side. But a lot of that is what that allows us to be, is that we're not reliant on all these other entities. So when something happens, we don't necessarily have to all of a sudden have this like knee jerk. We're necessarily involved in everything.
Sure.
Like, and that is one of those things where when I see that transition here, it is actually probably moving us towards a more quote unquote peaceful side on things, because we're not like economically trapped and like losing the leverage that is us being reliant on all of these different aspects.
You know, I think it's a choice, right? It's a choice of businesses to do business overseas and potentially take losses. Let me give you an example. So when Big Banana is in Guatemala and when they were a client state of the United States, and achieved independence from us and decided that they no longer wanted to provide slave labor for bananas, that when they approach the CIA and say, hey, could you overthrow the country and establish a 30-year civil war, killing hundreds of thousands of people, it'll be quick and easy and no big deal if you just go over and overthrow that country. Of course, they didn't know that it would cause a 30-year war, or maybe they did. I don't know. That the CIA says, no, sorry, but You don't get to rule another country. You can also do that, right? You can say that's an economic loss. Don't invest in other countries, right? If you don't want to take the possibility of that, or cut a deal. Maybe we'll go to the table and say, hey, let's cut a deal, a peaceful deal that says you'll keep United Banana there. Let them keep their businesses in practice. But we'll do something for you if you do that, right? I'm uncomfortable with that. It's when we systematically overthrow countries all over the world and then expect them not to dislike us and exploit them and then expect them to just take it as if we have some God-given right to the resources of the world and the markets of the world. That's not moral thinking.
Well, kind of what my...
Not attacking you. I'm only attacking this idea of, well, what we need to do is, in order to have prosperity, we need to dominate the world, which I think is a thesis of empire that all empires have, usually gets started on relatively modest terms and then turns into that as they rely on the state to guarantee their profits rather than allow for losses.
Well,
it's a corporatism
thing. Yeah, but like it's one of these things where like free trade in the current world is kind of a myth. The pencil essay is kind of a myth. What Milton Friedman kind of leaves out in that scenario is that in order to establish so that we can have like Argentinian lumber for this and then lead over here for this, is that there are cartels controlling all of that. That is like the practical reality of where we're at right now. Like we have Pepsi working with the CIA to conduct assassinations in Chile, right? Like that is kind of the, like we have this like fantasy notion that we've been existing in this free trade world for however long, because we're in this like free trade international order that is this like globalism paradigm or whatever. But like the reality is that it's all just cartel operated. Like, and I don't mean like the Mexican cartels. I mean like mob control, mafias,
including
like
the governments. The governments are just another kind of cartel. Yeah.
And then we're working or threatening or doing whatever in order to be able to establish these markets. And that is kind of how the economy has always operated, right?
There's a degree of spectrum, right? So there is a degree to which largely America was defined by a relatively non-corporatist, non-international foreign policy at a period in time in American history. And then after the banana wars, we've operated in a different paradigm.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's exactly what I'm saying.
Question. Like, it isn't. The problem that I have with the Ben's thesis on this is that it assumes that American prosperity comes from the empire. I actually think that the empire guarantees profits for some corporations. Yes, it does not guarantee American prosperity. It definitely softens the blow of American overregulation domestically, but I don't think that is where our prosperity comes from on a theoretical level. You have to zoom out a little bit and look at how prices and supply chains work and things like that. And you say, yes, there are extraction points along the way, but the comparison of division of labor and the abundance created by having larger systems of production themselves produce more, therefore make more things to solve more problems, that those things themselves are not dependent upon the empire. The empire simply exists to guarantee returns on those things. And that is a difference of theoretical framework that I have from Mike Benz, where I think he's making a judgment error on the theory.
Well, one of the things, because like this is just, you know, I could go through countless examples of this. Every time there's some sort of political hubbub in some country or other, all of a sudden you end up seeing like, okay, the Ukraine war goes, all of a sudden wheat futures go crazy. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden Egypt starts starving because of it. And you're just like, as a country, you don't want to be in a scenario where it's like, okay, something over here that I don't really have that much control over, all of a sudden, like, and Egypt's very fertile. Like, they got the Nile River, you know what I mean? Like you don't want to be in this situation. Like, you should have this safety aspect. Like, this is where it's like, I feel like there's like a spectrum between free trade and protectionism, and like probably free trade leaning and weighing more towards free trade, but having a certain layer of protectionism is probably useful for an actual nation state to operate, right? Because you have that safety bulwark that exists there, right? Where you, and this is where I'm using kind of like the entangling alliances quote from Washington, where it's like, the more that you become entangled and broiled with everybody else's business on this economic tie, all of a sudden it just becomes a lot messier and a lot more complicated. And you have to get involved in all of these different scenarios. Otherwise, your economy just goes all entirely out of whack. Like, for instance, yeah. Like, I know a lot of people were throwing up charts and stuff like that, but like, different prices, gold went up, stock futures went down. It's like, if you're looking at, say, crude oil right here, here's the crude oil futures, here's the candle from yesterday. It wicked at like 15% or so. They've had like a 15% swing. It came down halfway, so it's like 8% swing now. But like, all of a sudden you just see crude oil just skyrocketing 15%, and just like, okay. But like, we're all entangled in Middle Eastern oil and things like that right now. So we're just kind of like, that is the world that we live in. But if we were more producing our own at a much greater capacity, we wouldn't be so reliant on this. And we could kind of control our prices in such a way, right?
But also keeping a note that this is largely a prediction, if I understand it right, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Kyle, I don't know as much about this as you do, that because oil is so fungible, this is relying on the prediction of future interruptions into the international market. It has less to do than American oil energy production. We don't really import much oil from the Middle East as it is. This more has to do with European imports of oil.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. And so that's in part.
The problem is, and this is where Europe right now is in such a catch 22 in a lot of ways,
right,
is that they have none of these resources on their own. Like,
right,
the UK has resources, Scotland has oil, mm-hmm, but like the rest of Europe, like Norway has oil, but the rest of Europe has like nothing.
Yeah.
Right. So they are heavily reliant on Middle Eastern oil, and it's, mm-hmm, why they're so embroiled in the Iran, right, deals as well.
And
right.
Russian oil, Russian, mm-hmm, gas, Asia Minor area oil, natural gas, those sorts of things create the incentive for the hegemon to care about everything. Right, because we've had the philosophy of the goal of the hegemon is to guarantee everyone profits, and here's a mental model I just thought of, and maybe it's right, I don't know, vet me out real quick here. Mm-hmm. Too big to fail domestically when it comes to our big financial firms is the same phenomena, and probably a consequence of too big to fail or too important for international supply chains as it is for the hegemony. Mm-hmm. Right. It's the same philosophy, just it's like a boomerang effect. We've threw the boomerang out on, we need to make sure Big Banana has their thing, or BP Oil has their thing, or Europe has enough oil and gas. And what we caught back was, we got to bail out Bear Stearns.
Yeah.
You know, that's the same thing. Like, the government has to control everything philosophy, and it doesn't have to. You can take losses and adjust. And if you do so, in the long run, you'll probably have better outcomes, because you won't have to bankrupt your country. You won't have to, you know, kill a generation of young men in Middle Eastern wars. That is the trade-off. You cannot get one without the other. Is my suspicion of the mental model.
The counter that I would have to that, though, is, because, like, I would love to live in a world where everybody's just able to trade freely and kind of, you know, but, like, we have this paradigm where these where nation states exist, and they're conducting negotiations between nations on what can move through. So, like, it's one of those things where, like, even if America just went like, purely, we're just open to trade with everybody and stuff, like, we still have to deal with other nations that aren't like that, right?
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like, yep. So it becomes this thing where it's like, there's like this theoretical that would be really nice to have. And I think we would have better price discovery and all this stuff. We wouldn't have all these, like, our markets wouldn't be so out of whack from, like, an equilibrium standpoint of, like, where the prices actually are. But, like, we're still dealing with cartels at the end of the day. Like, everything, the world is run by cartels,
right? Who are operating in bad faith, who don't share your philosophy, who aren't trying to maximize productivity. Other than that, the maximizing of productivity through low barriers helps you outcompete and does spread around the world. The reduction of English corn laws in the 19th century was the precursor to the British Empire. It is something that they built their trade networks on and then layered an empire on top of. That gets flipped around, and people say, well, you had the British Empire, so therefore that's how they got prosperous. It's actually the other way around. They built, with the Dutch and others, built large trade networks, mostly through voluntary contracts and mostly through, you know, discovery of where resources were and then cutting deals, and then later layered on imperial ambitions and colonization and things like that on top of it. Mm-hmm. That is, it depends on how you're telling your story that will give you the lesson about whether or not it's a net good. And I'm just saying, I'm not saying that everyone has to embrace the philosophy for it to work. I'm saying that in those scenarios, we do have historical interpretation and historical data to suggest that expansion of these things is a net good for everybody, even as you have bad actors who are trying to cartelize and things like that too, because cartelization itself is super inefficient. It doesn't create the best outcomes for the people who are doing it, because all it takes is one person to jump outside of it, and all of a sudden the cartel breaks apart. Well, you have the economic data on that. It's very consistent.
Unless you can continue to establish your cartel by force, right? Like, yes. And that's just like,
that's why government cartels are the most dangerous ones, right?
That's why it's just there's like a geopolitical realism that I try to always look at the trade side with, where it's like, mm-hmm. you know, like, I have the things where it's like, I believe, like, in the ideal world, there's like a very specific, like, this is the correct way to approach it. But, like, there's also just in the here and now, that's not the world we're looking at. And we can continue to try to move towards that in some way, but it's like, we're very far from that right now. And I don't think that we should be, because, like, the current international world trade order right now is there's like this myth that I feel like needs to be completely dispelled, that that we've had this, like, globalized free trade system. Like, that's not how the world has operated.
Right. I'm not trying to operate in that. I want to do just a few reactions. I would want to look at APAC's reaction, because I think it is insightful for the other variables that are at play when it comes to this particular fight.
So APAC said, thank you, President Donald Trump, for providing Israel with the necessary resources to defend itself against Iran's nuclear program, which also poses a threat to America. Iran's refusal to accept the offer made by the president and Steve Witkoff forced Israel to take action. It is interesting how Steve Witkoff was anti-Semitic like 3 weeks ago. I will say that's interesting.
A couple other things in here to note. Defend itself against Iran's nuclear program when there's no evidence that they have a nuclear weapon or are proceeding to get one, according to the DNI, but not according to the Austrian FBI. They're very skeptical of this. And then additionally, that noting that this is, you know, I think some evidence to suggest that this was a ruse beyond, like, they're kind of like plucking at this idea that underneath this was, you know, really the threat and the good cop, bad cop. and defend itself. Like, it's interesting how many of these tweets come out as they are defending themselves when this is an aggressive action from Israel to Iran.
That's where the pray for Israel thing was like so weird. It's to so me, weird. Where I was just like, I'm seeing like, it was like, Israel makes attack, and then I see Caitlyn Jenner being like, pray for Israel. Like, what?
Yeah, yeah. You're like, here's another one. So Kamala Harris is this, that one. This is Kamala Harris's former national security advisor. And this is that, you know that thing where it's like the bullet shot at Trump thing, and it's like war with Iran for Israel, then war with Iran for Israel in either case. She wrote, this statement from Secretary Rubio conveys that Israel struck Iran without the umbrella of American support. While Biden twice deployed U.S. troops and resources to defend Israel against direct Iranian attacks last year, Trump isn't promising Israel defense against Iranian counterstrike. He does later. Though it's clearly planning for one. Grateful that successive Democratic administrations have provided Israel with the means to defend itself. That is the uniparty. We would have been here no matter what, because this is the national security.
I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, it's one of those things where last night I was seeing a lot of stuff where it was like, there was a lot of like old things happening that people were claiming were currently happening. Yeah. Like there was a lot of that stuff, but I believe America did provide air defense support in counterstrikes last night. Was that something that happened?
I wasn't aware of any Iranian counterstrikes so far. Yeah. So I don't think that was a thing.
Okay. Cause that's one of those things where I saw that right as I went to bed and I was like, oh, that's interesting. But I haven't like re-corroborated that since then.
I don't think so. I didn't see anything like that. Okay. I mean, there were lots of videos of Iran's attack last year on it. Some of the ones, remember when they used the hypersonics
I kept finding videos that were things from last time.
Yeah. So be aware. A lot of disinformation campaigns.
Well, I mean, it's the same thing that went with the riots that we covered last episode. Like so many people were bringing in footage of old riots from 2020. Mm-hmm. And it's like, no, these aren't the things that are happening right now, but people are using it to clickbait and engagement farm. Right.
Right. Right. Right. And another one from Laura Loomer, I think is kind of insightful for how some of the folks that claim to be America first are engaging on this from the Trump right.
Is Laura America first?
Yeah. Israel has a right to defend itself from a genocidal nuclear Iranian regime. Now, let's be clear. The only one in this scenario that has nukes is Israel. The only one actually conducting an ethnic removal of a population that is, you know, that some people, including the folks at the UN, say is a genocide, is Israel. So the entire inversion of everything from the people on this in order to justify what's going on is kind of crazy to see in this moment. It's insightful for how people are thinking of this, because it is either so echo chambery or so like in the mono narrative, they can't even see their own hypocrisy in this.
Well, and Israel tends to do that all the time. Like there's a lot of exactly that where it's like, we're doing this thing, but then we're like, it's like,
yeah, that ambulance we blew up. 60% Hamas. Actually, we didn't blow it up. Oh, actually, we did. But it was 60% Hamas.
There's a lot of that goes on with Israel. But also, it's like, I brought this up in the Skiff episode that we did on covering the Mark Levin stuff. But a lot of this just reminds me of exactly how Israel's nuclear program came into fruition back during the JFK era, where there's a lot of like, all the things that they're claiming Iran is doing with their nuclear program is like exactly what Israel did back in the 60s at the time, where it's like JFK is going in and he's like working with Ben Gurion at the time. Yep. And he's like trying to be like, okay, we need to have inspectors that come in and do all this stuff. We want to make sure nobody in the Middle East has a nuke. And like, that was the American position at the time. And then underhandedly, there's countries slipping in uranium and they're hiding, and Israel's like hiding the nuclear weapon development from the American inspectors at the time. Mm-hmm. And then JFK gets assassinated, and then we get over to LBJ, and it's just like,
whatever.
And then Nixon comes in and is like, we have a new policy called don't ask, don't tell. But like, that was the Israeli nuclear development project. There was them lying to us, slipping in French uranium, and then developing their thing. So like, there's a lot of concern that Iran might wind up doing that. But it's like, yeah, but that's how Israel got their nukes to start with. Like, they're worried that Iran might do the thing that Israel did.
Yes.
You're like,
Yes, as they still deny that they have nukes, as they rely, according to Scott
Ritter.
They don't deny anymore.
They now...
Oh, no.
No, their official policy is to say, we won't talk about how many nukes we have. Like, that's like their official policy.
Oh, no. Piers Morgan was interviewing Bibi Netanyahu, who would not confirm whether or not they had nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
And the reason why they can't do that is because they developed that in violation of international law. Right. So if they did that, that would require all the other signatures of the non-proliferation treaty to decide whether or not they actually meant it. And then they would sanction Israel.
Yeah. Also on Piers Morgan, he had a whole debate amongst all the spies. He had like Kiriakou. Yeah. And like there was, and Scott Horton was on that too. Yeah. And then they had the former head of Mossad, and the whole former head of Mossad was like, is our official policy to say that we do not know how many nukes we have?
No, it's a thing that they can't publicly admit that, because then that could be used as evidence in the UN to implement a sanction regime. Now, Scott Ritter is claiming, and he was a UN weapons inspector in Iraq in the 1990s, so he understands these systems quite well. Say whatever else you want about him, he does know this stuff. And he claims that the IAEA probably slipped information from their inspections to America intelligence, then to Israel, to target these attacks. Mm. So just think about that for a minute when you think about American coordination here. If the IAEA is an arm of American intelligence, of course Iran would hide things from them, because that's the only way to guarantee their own national sovereignty.
Otherwise, it's all intelligence games.
Otherwise, they're Libya. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, intelligence is the crucial thing here. And there's just a lot of people operating on intelligence that the public has no idea what's going on. And that's how geopolitical games are played. So we're sitting in this kind of fog of war as the commentariat class, as the plebs.
Yeah.
We have to sit here and kind of operate with what we're getting from anonymous officials on what's going on. It's just like, you know, it's hard for us to fully understand the extent of the games that are being played, and we have 100%. To speculate at. I think this Sunday, the Steve Witkoff, if we get public information on the meetings on Sunday, assuming they're still going through, I think we'll have a lot clearer of a picture going into next week on where this is going. It will be very curious to see if Iran retaliates in any meaningful way. I imagine they will. They'll hit like strategic points or something like that. Now, if they end up hitting some sort of American thing, like an American base or something like that, that's going to be, I imagine they wouldn't do that. That feels strategically unwise, but maybe they'll do something like that, which would cause much broader problems, I would say.
Yeah. I mean, Iran's response was, the Zionist regime's aggressive actions against Iran cannot have been carried out without the coordination and authorization of the United States. Accordingly, the United States government, as the main supporter of this regime, will also be responsible for the dangerous effects and consequences of the Zionist regime's adventure. That's from the Iranian foreign ministry.
Well, so, and that's going to be the big question.
That's the question. Does this escalatorily spiral from here, or does Iran show restraint? The only adult in the room now is Iran to decide whether or not we're going to escalate this after we are now backing Israel's aggressive action.
Well, and I'm just reminded of all the previous things that have happened where there will be strategic points that, like, I imagine what's going to happen is there's going to be a strategic tit for tat that happens. That they'll even probably provide warning ahead of time where it's like, evacuate your military base, et cetera. We are striking these people, because that's what Iran often does. Whereas like, we are going to take out this American military base, but we give you 24 hours notice beforehand. You know, like it'll be that type of a thing that happens, unless they go beyond what they've done before, which is always possible. They might go beyond this. This was a bigger attack than a lot of previous attacks.
Israel's gone beyond what they've had before too.
Yeah, so exactly.
That's that. What will they do? All right. I think that wraps up the episode. Thank you so much for watching. Go to humanreactionpod.com. Get yourself a hat like Kyle's. Look at that beautiful thing. You can also get our super awesome gay plywood if you are facing a riot in your neighborhood. No, you can't. But that's kind of funny.
You deleted my link to the image.
Yeah.
Sad. I would have showed it. Get your gay plywood. We don't actually have gay plywood.
Don't tell the people that. They're supposed to go there, and then they'll maybe decide to become a member.
That's the other thing, too. Like, this weekend's going to be wild. Because, we also have the No Kings protest stuff that's going on. So we have this question of, where's the Iran situation going on? And then what is happening with these protests? Like, our Tuesday, when we come back to record on Tuesday, it might be a very different world.
Maybe a new war in the Middle East. You never know.
Maybe a new war in California.
Make sure to like, subscribe, comment, send this podcast to your mono narrative friends. Say, hey, if you want a different perspective, check these guys out. they kind of know what they're talking about sometimes. So thank you so much for watching. Have a great week.
Thanks for tuning in to Human Reaction. Please be sure to like, follow, subscribe, and give us a review on your podcast platform of choice. And if you want to become a member and support the show financially, check out humanreactionpod.com.